Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. Hi, Ryan. Thank you for joining me today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before we get started with our conversation, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. It's my pleasure to join you here today, Jason. My name is Ryan Robinetz, and I work for Albion College, school in Michigan, small liberal arts institution. I came into fundraising about 10 years ago, where I started at Wilson Bennett Technology, a phone-a-thon company. And was able to work my way up the ladder there, and then found that I was no longer doing the things that I loved doing about fundraising, and that was working with donors individually. So about 5 years ago, I joined the team at Albion College as an engagement officer. And now, 5 years later, I'm running the engagement team, which has been a lot of fun to learn how we holistically do meaningful and personalized interaction with our donor base. So that's me.
That's good. So Ryan, when you reached out to me, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, you were telling me about the graduate program you were involved in. And I really want to do a deep dive today into that. You also mentioned that you had just recently read my book. And then you just shared with me an interesting fact that you're about 10 years into your fundraising career. One of the things that I did not indicate in that book, and I sort of figured out sort of after the fact, is that in many ways, the person that I was writing to was that person who was about 10 years into their fundraising career. It's kind of that person who they're sort of beyond the credentialing, the idea of getting a CFRE and all those sorts of things that happen in the sort of the competency zone. But it's the person who's about 10 years in and who's starting to think critically about what it is they're doing. Maybe they pursue a graduate program like you were involved in. And so a lot of the stuff that I put in that book is along the lines of the things that my guess is when you were reading it were things that you were saying, yeah, I've thought that before, or, hey, I'm glad he finally said that. Or, yeah, I've heard that said by someone else. Is that kind of does that accurately describe you?
Yeah. So, as I was going through the book, I found it fascinating if there was a chapter called, A Tale of Two Ryans. I felt I could fit into that third Ryan.
Right.
It was really interesting to see how as we were progressing through the book and as we were looking at those things, it fit right along with the capstone that I'm preparing to write, that I'm writing right now. So it was a well-timed read. I'll put it that way.
That's funny. And so are you, if you don't mind me asking, I'm guessing, are you maybe about in your early 30s at the oldest?
Yes. Yes. I'm 33 years old. Proudly yeah, 33.
So you're just a couple of years older than those two Ryans. And they both came into their fundraising career about 10 years ago. And a lot of the observations that I made and continue to make as I interact with one of them in particular more often than the other is just that they sort of represent this generation of fundraising professionals different than myself, because I've been in it for a little more than two decades. And unlike unlike them and unlike yourself, there's a certain degree of deliberateness. There's certainly a degree of intentionality that I think a lot of people my age and older didn't necessarily come into the profession with. It's very common, for instance, for me to hear my peers and anyone older than me say that they sort of came into the profession very haphazardly, or we came through the back door, or we're accidental fundraisers. And then as I talk to younger people, so people your age, and certainly anyone coming into it that's younger than you, they're coming, like the graduates, like the college students that I teach over at the college, they're choosing fundraising and certainly nonprofit management as a career path. And so their confidence level, you know, like this is my domain, this is my professional space, is much more real, and they own it very differently than I would say I would. Is that consistent for you as well?
Yeah, I feel like I have a little bit of both stories. Before going to Wilson-Bennett, I actually worked in the banking industry, ironically and unfortunately, during our last recession. So coming out of that and falling into fundraising and then quickly finding that, you know, I was, this is where I belonged. When I knew I needed to continue to progress and to learn. And, you know, once that the ability to do that, at Albion came about, it was, almost, I want to say love at second sight, but something like that.
Yeah. And maybe perhaps it's that, people like yourself. So I've gotten to know, there was a woman who was on my book launch team. Gotten to know her really well. She's in the West Chicago suburbs, working for a nonprofit organization, and one of the things, and she might would describe herself very similar. Like she sort of owns both stories, sort of straddling the fence on sort of both cohorts of fundraisers. But I think what she found in my book differently than probably some of the stuff that she had read previously was the idea was this idea of thinking critically, and that's a lot of what I'm trying to do, sort of translate to here on this onto the podcast here, is this notion of getting the fundraising professional and sort of the profession as a whole to think more critically about what it is we're doing. I have to ask, and I think about my own graduate school experience. Would you say that the program that you're in is probing you to think critically about what it is we're doing, or do you sometimes wonder if you're not getting that?
So one of the really great things about the program that I'm in, and that's at LaGrange College, unfortunately, we're the last graduating class for the program, but I came in with a cohort of three other Albion people. So there were four of us in the cohort at the beginning. What we were able to do is really take the things that we were talking about in class, and it was basically, you know, a learning laboratory for us. And we've been able to put a lot of the things that we've talked about and collaborated and worked together on in practice. So a lot of times, you know, that people go into their master's courses and, they're doing it for the lack of better terms, the piece of paper that comes along with it. And that was something that, we weren't going to settle for. Because we could have done that, and it could have been not the best use of all of our time. But since all four of us were in there together, and we were looking at it through our Albion lens and through our institution's lens, we were able to put a lot of things into practice within the first, you know, year or two of the program. And so it's a 26-month program, and we're coming to the end of it here pretty soon.
So Ryan, what's your take on sort of where, so you're at this 10-year point, you're graduating from this program, you're reading books like mine, you're jumping onto podcasts. So fundraising is sort of, you're owning it as a professional identity. And then COVID-19 comes along and sort of kicks us all in the gut. And we probably all had plans and dreams, maybe like you did. It sounds like you're very happy where you're at. And so you're not planning on packing up and going anywhere else. But, you know, what do you think the landscape looks like for a 10-year veteran fundraiser? I tend to, you know, just to answer my own question, I tend to be much more optimistic. I think the opportunities for a young person who's saying, I want to be a fundraiser, I want to be a donor-facing individual securing meaningful gifts, I think those opportunities are going to be even more extraordinary in the near future. Is that where you're at, or are you in a different place?
No, I think so. You know, it's really hard to say because we're sitting in the middle of the trees trying to look at the forest, if you will. But I think that right now, anything and things that I'm instructing my team to do is this is the time to learn. This is the time to build and to grow, not just for yourself, but, you know, coming out of all of this and all of the change. And I hate the term the new normal because I don't think this is the new normal. But we're going to learn how we're all going to interact with donors. We're going to learn all of those things now. I think there's great opportunity. And I think the seatbelt is kind of off right now. So that's great because we don't have to be locked into a place anymore. And I think that's one of the biggest things that I think that the industry itself had always said, well, we want you to come into the office. We want you to learn the culture of the organization. We want you to be here. But I think that it was moving towards a little bit more, you know, work with the donors where they're at. So for example, my territory for Albion is the West Coast of the United States. But you know, I live in Michigan. So that's always kind of hard. I had to fly to Seattle every other week or something like that. So I think that the remote opportunities for some of the more experienced fundraisers that are very comfortable with being in the office, I think that's changing with someone that's my age or younger. We're okay with being wherever we are and trying to serve the mission of the institution.
I have never heard that expression, the seatbelt's off, but that's also, I want to mess with that for a minute. When the seatbelt's off, it affords you some freedom, but it also can be very dangerous. Yep. So what's the inherent danger that we're sort of to sort of riff on your, cause I think you're right. I think we're going to, and that's what a lot of people in the media are talking about right now, how the workplace is just going to have to give. And we're going to see a lot of people working remotely, and we're going to realize that a lot of the assumptions that we had were wrong. I think you can form culture without, I think proximity is being redefined. You know, I think platforms like you and I are sitting on right now create proximity in ways that we didn't originally think they could. But what is that danger that's sort of inherent in the idea that the seatbelt's off?
Yeah, I think it's the idea of losing control over what your people are doing. You know, one of the things that you talked about in your book was the people that wanted to lead, right? And follow me, I'm going this way, I'm going to lead us going. And, you know, I think those people that are doing that, if they lose control over the proximity of where people are, it tends to cause a little bit of disturbance. And, you know, if we can manage it right, we can use all these awesome technology tools that we have from, you know, video conferencing to all of the, you know, Microsoft Teams and Google platform and all of that. I mean, I'm right next to my team all the time remotely. I don't really necessarily need to be in the office next door. Think that's part of the danger is people not wanting to conform or change. Change is hard. So I think that a lot of the people that are used to the technology and are diving in and able to reach donors with technology too are going to have a much easier time if the seatbelt is off.
Very grateful that you read the book and you very evidently read it. You know, there's that point in there where I talk about the inverse relationship between growth and control. That's an idea that Wasserman did some research at Harvard, and he was talking about how enterprises that are led by very growth-oriented versus very control-oriented leaders and sort of where these enterprises go. And I think the workplace in general for about the last 100 years has been very control-oriented. A lot of this comes from the Industrial Revolution and those times when we were trying to create very controlled, predictable spaces. And at times, I think fundraising is sort of that last professional domain that has sort of become the victim of that. maybe the opportunity that a guy like you and a guy like me see is that if we could shift to the more growth-oriented mindset and say that, you know, some of these constraints that we put on our people and some of the ways that we see this working aren't necessarily healthy and not necessarily helpful. Here's an example, Ryan. I'm kind of wandering, but I had a guest on here, Ryan, talk to me about the idea that instead of a new employee becoming culturally oriented towards the internal culture, that a fundraiser needs to get out there first and foremost and get out there in front of the donor. You know, are we finally going to get to the point? And I thought that was brilliant. I was like, absolutely. That's the person that the new major gifts officer needs to be interacting with. But I don't know if that's the first impulse. Is that sort of what you're seeing? Is that our impulses might change? Our patterns might change a little bit?
I think it gives us an opportunity to, you know, one of the things that, you know, if we see somebody in our office all the time and they're not in front of the donor, they're not doing their job to the best of their ability. So I think that this allows us to say, hey, you don't have to be in this office. Go talk to the people that you're supposed to be talking to. Make relationships with the people you're supposed to be building relationships with. So I definitely think that it's kind of taken the issue with people being locked into their desk and now saying, let's go, let's get out there. So I think that that's a major, major player in this. It also kind of may weed out, and I hate saying this in that way, but those folks that really are struggling with, you know, asking for money and they're afraid of rejection and getting out and, you know, talking to the people that may say no to them, even though it's one of their core functions as a major gift officer or engagement officer.
Yeah. So what were some of these questions that you were in this capstone project that you're pulling together? Before we hit the record button, you were sharing with me some of the questions you're trying to ask, and I want to make sure our listeners have the benefit of that.
Sure. So what I was trying to identify is if I were a new VP coming into a new organization, what would I need to know and what would I want to build as far as our culture? And how would I keep our top fundraising professionals in the roles that they're in? A lot of times we've heard that, you know, 14 to 18 month job tenure for frontline fundraisers, and I hope it's not that bad, but that's what I've heard. You know, how do we keep those people in the position to learn for 24, 26 months and then start building. So one of the questions that I had for you, Jason, was, you know, besides a paycheck, which everyone says, you know, that's the main factor of, you know, why people leave their job, they're not getting paid enough. What other factors are you seeing that have really played into and started and continued this war on for fundraising talent?
I have oftentimes said, Ryan, that I think fundraising, where it currently finds itself, has a supervisor problem, not a fundraiser problem. I think we're struggling so much to figure out what it means to supervise a fundraiser effectively. And in the process, we try to supervise them like all these other roles. You know, we draw from all these other different professional domains. We draw from, you know, from marketing or from sales or from somewhere. You know, we sort of piece it all together. And I think fundraising has got to get to the place where it says, okay, let's sort of cut the cord and start to think for ourselves and recognize that our work is particularly unique. It's not sales, it's not marketing, it's not advertising, it's not PR. It needs to sort of exist in its own space. And then by doing that, we can begin to ask the right questions. Like, how do I hire a guy like Ryan and make sure that I'm hiring the right Ryan? Or once I've got him on my payroll, how do I make sure that he's doing his the right work? You know, at the back end of that book, for example, I talk a lot about out the differences between inputs and outputs in our work. I think we've become so focused on the outputs, which is to say how much money we're raising, that a lot of your bosses don't know how to supervise almost exclusively on inputs, which is to say, the number of meetings that we're doing, what type of asks are being made, what type of donors are we interacting with. There's a lot of variables that are truly within our control that ultimately, when you think critically about them, really do yield better outcomes. But all we're looking at is how much money did Ryan raise this month? And I just don't, that's just not a variable that we have all that much control over. Ultimately, it's in the hands of the donor how much money they choose to give. And I think we've tried so much to leap over the table, if you will, and like force the donor's hand on that check and say, write this amount, almost literally and figuratively at the same time. That's just not how it works. And that's the pressure. That's the tension that you're writing in that paper without expressing it that way. That's essentially, I think, that tension that's causing this turnover, is that we think we can somehow or another craft the job description in a way where the development officer can literally like write the check on the behalf of the donor. Does that make sense?
Yeah. One thing that I, in reading your book, one of the things that I kind of started laughing at because I found it to be particularly true is just because a fundraiser has a boatload of experience doesn't mean that will always translate to the next place. And a lot of times their success is based on, you know, where they were, who they were talking to, what relationships they had built in that time period. So I thought that was a fascinating take on, you know, having somebody that's coming in hungry to learn, hungry to talk to the right people and build those relationships at their next place too.
Historically, I have spent a lot of my time consulting in the K-12 independent school space. And I was trying to find talented fundraisers to work for these organizations, but these organizations were competing for talent that was let's call them beyond their reach. They were, they were sort of at the place where you're at, right? They're 10 plus years of experience. Their compensation levels had sort of exceeded what the K-12 school was accustomed to paying. And quite frankly, the K-12 school could not create an environment for the development officer to do the type of work that higher education could, for example, provide for them. And the case I was trying to make, which is along the lines of sort of your question here, is I was saying I can go out and I can find a relatively, almost a completely inexperienced individual who has no presumptions about how fundraising works. I can teach them some basic things. And this person within about 12 to 18 months can be doing the work that a 5 or 10 year veteran fundraiser can do if they'll just do the right steps very early in the process. Sometimes I say in my seminar, Ryan, I say, give me a completely inexperienced individual, give them a list of 150 current donors. Right. So give them a list of current donors. Tell them that all they can do is pick up the phone, say thank you, and ask for a meeting. Right. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you, if they do that, so all they do is talk to current donors, say thank you, and ask for a meeting. And if the donor says yes, then you follow through on that meeting. My experience tells me that person will raise a whole lot more money, even if they're not even asking, if they're being set up in that sort of way. But so many organizations have these preconceived notions of what experience really is and what value it brings. I think the context you were sort of raising with your question is that idea that sort of we can bring experience with us. Well, when it comes to fundraisers, a lot of times that experience is the relationship that we have with another donor. And certainly unless I'm staying put in the same community, I'm not literally bringing that donor with me.
Right.
Experience in this context of fundraising is not a fully transferable sort of thing. And I think we just have these exaggerated notions of what experience really is. So anyway, I was trying to offer my clients a candidate who would come at a lower, salary range, but trying to also at the same time assure them that, hey, we can actually accomplish some great things if you'll create this type of environment where they can shine. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Our engagement team is similar to that. They're all pretty much just out of college or, second job in fundraising, 2-3 years of experience tops. But we're looking for that. And it was interesting that you had also mentioned it in your book. We're looking for that curious chameleon, someone who can flex their dialects, things that they think about. They're just super curious about different people and different industry. They're able to then distill all the information that comes to them. Because a lot of times in a hour long meeting, you're going to have a lot of information, most of which is not typically valuable. But you're building that relationship, and how do you then strategically solicit from there if that is the next path for that donor? So that's who we're looking for, and we're lucky at Albion to have that. And I think it's because it's a learning organization. You know, we're encouraged to go get our master's in philanthropy, and we're encouraged to innovate and change and do things that kind of upset the apple cart, which is really nice. And we're going to fail. I mean, we fail probably more than we succeed, but when we do succeed, we succeed big. So it's been a lot of fun to be in that environment where we're able to learn and lead from any position that we're in. It doesn't have to be from top down.
Getting the organization to say, okay, let's find somebody who is, relatively inexperienced, who can be trained to do this really well, but that let's also acknowledge that this person is going to be far more valuable to you in about, 18 to 24 months.
Right.
And so I have done this. I'm currently doing this with one client. I've certainly done it with others. It's the idea of negotiating a compensation plan that aligns with sort of recognizing that at 24 months, this development officer, if they were, if they were onboarded correctly, at about 24 months, they're going to become extremely valuable to you, because if they've done everything you told them to do, they've now engaged with your donors, they've warmed up some of these relationships, they're probably soliciting some pretty meaningful gifts, and now they're really going to pay for themselves. And now they're also going to be pretty impressive when that recruiter calls them and says, hey, are you interested in this other opportunity? And I think, again, I go back to what I said earlier when you asked the question, I think this is a supervisor problem, not a fundraiser problem. I think if supervisors and HR departments recognize the value that the development officer creates, not at the beginning of their tenure, but at the 2-year mark in their tenure, and then strategically thought through, okay, where do we need to set this person up so that essentially they think they're getting essentially I'm saying to these people, look, we're going to essentially forbid this development officer at the beginning of year two from even having any desire to want to go look somewhere else, because anything that they could go out and find, you're already committed to giving them. So whether it's additional incentives, whether it's additional compensation, whether it's like in your case, you're talking about a graduate degree. So say, for instance, you could actually negotiate that into a contract and say at the beginning of year two, we'll start, or, the beginning of year three, for example, we'll start paying for your master's degree. That's going to be huge in terms of, if I'm talking to a fundraiser who's, less than 10 years into their career. In my mind, I'm thinking that's a fundraiser who's much less likely to jump ship and go want to work for somebody else.
Absolutely. Be completely transparent. That's one of the reasons that Albion did offer that to a few of us. We had found that we had some really good talent on the team and said, okay, let's incentivize them staying here, because we're a small liberal arts institution. We don't have the ability to go out and throw around paychecks like the, Publix or healthcare fundraising does. So we're not super small, but we're not, we're not even medium. we're somewhere small, medium. So saying that you can go get some mastery in your role, and you can have some autonomy in the work you're doing, goes a long way for sure.
I was initially writing to that small, K through 12 independent school. That was generally who my audience was. And some of the, I guess I could say that some of the parachurch organizations that I've historically worked with as well. But interesting, in light of what you're saying to me about what you all are aspiring to do, I also noticed that a lot of the people who picked up that book were from some of these smaller higher ed institutions, a lot of them private liberal arts colleges, who were competing for talent and were oftentimes viewed in the shadows of these larger, say, D1 schools, right?
Right.
And I can think of a woman from top of Michigan. You probably know the school. So she travels. She hires a team. She has to manage a team, but it's one of the hardest places to find talent, keep talent. It's not the place where everybody wants to go. But she travels, after she reads my book, she travels all the way to Washington, D.C. to participate in one of my seminars. And this is the type of institution that I'm talking about. It's not the University of Michigan. It's not some big elite school where talent gravitates, but it's a place where she knows she has to think more creatively about how she finds talent, how she creates talent, how she retains them, and then in some ways what the expectations are for them. Because obviously, you know, there's a different level of, I suspect that this institution is not raising on money on the same scale that Michigan may be, for example.
It's really interesting to see kind of how I'll know somebody at one of those schools and they're doing great work. And then all of a sudden, you know, like clockwork, 18 months in, they're at one of the 2 to 3 big schools in the state, or they took a job with a hospital in the area. So it's almost like we have to find these ways to be creative, to create incentive for the small, quote unquote, small schools in the area.
I also tend to think that that there may be a distinguishing characteristic of some of the fundraisers like yourself who are willing to stay the longer term. And I think it's got to be some, and I haven't figured this out, I'm totally just sort of shooting from the hip here, but what is it about a fundraiser who sticks around not only for those first 2 years, right? And maybe, you know, hits some good runs, but knows that the value of these relationships that they're forming with these individuals is more valuable to them on, say a 10-year scale rather than a 2-year scale. You know, they see that. They see and experience and value that. There's a cohort of, and I see them everywhere I go, and I don't pick this vibe up with you, but they are the ones who sort of hinge a lot of their language, for example, on sales. Mm-hmm. So they literally feel like they're doing, that they're a salesperson and they can just hop from job to job and they're just sort of closing deals. And those tend to be the ones that I think are driving down these averages. But I also tend to think that those are not the ones that could actually sit down with me and have a conversation about how they have very intimately gotten to know a major donor and walked them through a series of gifts and been invited to a wedding or something. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Even besides just the relationship with these individual major donors that I've been fortunate to work alongside and, you know, sometimes it's just their first gift and sometimes it's their lifetime gift, which is varies at different sizes. But the other part is, you know, we're in the middle of a comprehensive campaign and, you know, I'd never experienced that previously. And I've been able to see from start to finish, hopefully coming up soon, an entire comprehensive campaign, which is amazing. And I've seen the growth in our team and our staff and have seen a president almost from start to finish, who, you know, he's retiring this year. So those types of things are completely invaluable. I couldn't imagine just jumping ship at, you know, the first offer that came through. Because there has been, you know, there have been offers. It's just not,
sure,
it's just not something that was appealing at that time to go out and do because of the culture in the office. So getting back to that capstone, I'm really excited to kind of see how to replicate and transform this paper to basically allow a track record or a guide for all of our VPs all over the country who really need to continue to keep the talent in the office.
Yeah. So what is that question? Before I let you go, so what's that sort of that unanswered question that you're still sort of that you even worry that you may not find an answer to?
Can the little guy still win? I think is the question, you know, and talking about some of the people that I know pretty well from the other schools that have that are great fundraisers and they're great people. And I would hire them on my team if I had the opportunity. Why did they leave? You know, why was it so appealing to go to one of these larger nonprofits? Was it the pay? Was it autonomy? Was it that they weren't getting the management that they needed at the schools that they were at or the nonprofit that they were at? So what is the answer? And I don't know if we'll ever find the answer, but I'm going to keep searching.
Do you think that sort of this COVID-19 reality in front of us is going to help bring some clarity in much the same way that we were talking about sort of workplace environments and some of the naive assumptions that we made? So of those sort of those itching questions that you are still yet unanswered, do you think this is going to help answer at least one of them?
I think it has to, right? There's going to be so much shaking of different questions, and there's going to be so much answered from coming out of this crisis, and so many things. And I, you know, we talked about what the new normal is or what the new normal will be. But I think that if we can find a couple answers from that, whether it's, you know, not having a static workplace environment and allowing people to be wherever they're going to be, maybe that helps retain talent at some of these small rural schools. You know, and what's the game plan for that? How does that work as far as management goes? So I think some things will get answered, and I think the crisis will help. But I think we're too far in it still to figure out what it will be.
Yeah. I'm very much with you, Ryan. Ryan, if there is somebody that's listening to the podcast today, they know how to find me. I'm relatively easy to find on social media, but they're looking for you. How would you suggest that they do that?
LinkedIn's probably the best way. I'm on LinkedIn almost all the time. And that's just linkedin.com/in/RyanRobinette. That's probably the best way to reach me.
Totally cool, Ryan. Well, hold on for a moment. I'm going to hit the end of the record button, and you're always welcome back.
Thank you so much. It was a blast.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.